a student member on the panel, but unfortunately they're really ill and can't be with us today. But all four of the people who are on this panel are people that I've been talking with for some time about learning and teaching, and they've all inspired my own practice in one way or another. And so this is like a very exciting thing for me to have all four of them in one place talking with us. So I'll introduce them very briefly, and then I'll tell you what we've done. And we have one microphone, so we're going to do a little microphone sharing here today. So the four people we have are Divya Shanant, who's here at the University of Westminster, Stephanie Davies, who's at the University of East London, Avi Bukley, who's at the Open University, which is a wee way up the line, and Raf Banato, who's at City University, which is also here in London. And what we did was we posed them sort of four things to think about in advance, and we're going to ask them to talk to us about their thoughts on that, and then we're going to open it up for questions and for your thoughts so there can be a bit of dialogue and conversation. But I just wanted to let you know that we're recording the round table. The only part that will go up online, though, is what the four people here at the front talk about. We will edit out all of your questions and comments so that you're not out in public about your thoughts, which are possibly not preformed. So the first thing we asked you to do, actually, was just to introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about the spaces or space that you occupy in the world of learning and teaching. And there's no particular order that you need to answer in, so I'm just going to hand the microphone into the middle bit and let you go from there.
Can people hear okay? That's okay, isn't it? It's not too loud, not too quiet. Thanks. Lovely. So I'm Raf, and just to say that I'm slightly over-caffeinated as somebody who never drinks caffeine. So please excuse my possible sort of rather hasty ramblings at the beginning. And I think, is Ruth in the room? Yes. I thought my t-shirt, think of it in an ironic way today, especially after what you were talking about, and I think in terms of what we're going to be talking about on the panel. So I think, the question is, say something about the space you occupy in learning and teaching, and I think for me that's quite hard to do without talking about, starting by talking about the space that I feel I occupy in the world, I suppose. So I just wanted to very quickly kick off with that, I suppose, positioning myself. And I think that's something I want to come back to later on during the panel. But I suppose I identify as a white, queer top, I suppose, dirty top, from. And I think that's the sort of a space that I occupy, but I'm also the child of two immigrants, Spanish and Italian parents, brought up in London, speaking no English until I went to school, and feeling, so from very early on, feeling other in that sense, and then my developing queer identity. So I think that's one place that I come from. I think that's important to say. But in terms of what I do, I work at City at the moment, and I'm a senior lecturer in, my title is Education Development, and part of my role in the School of Health Sciences, I think it's important to say that part of my role is about having keeping an eye on sort of health policy, and then trying to work with colleagues within the school to devise programs to meet the new roles and new things that are identified on a policy level via new programs. So that's one of the things I do. But I'm also the sort of token sort of homo queer person in my school. So I end up, not that I'm the only one, but I seem to be one of the only ones who does the teaching. Lots of ping-ponging.
Sorry.
That's okay. So any teaching that involves, so it's the School of Health Sciences, we're preparing people from a range of across a range of clinical programs, except medics actually, and teach everybody else, to work with an incredibly diverse community, you know, in London, across the UK, potentially across the world. So that means that they have to have an element of cultural sensitivity and teaching around the kinds of people and bodies and identities that they're going to come across in practice, and increasingly so. So a lot of that teaching falls to me, partly. So sometimes I'm asked to do it, but more often I'm actually somebody who asks to do that. So trying to include, making sure that every program has got content around non-binary identities, around different bodies, around different gender identities. So that at least I feel if I'm doing it, at least I know it's happening. Whether I'm the appropriate person to do it is another matter, and maybe we can talk about, you know, who should teach what. So that's where I've been, and I've been at City for 12 years, and before that I was 9 years in a medical school working with medical students, but mostly GPs in practice and allied staff. So thinking about how to do education, but out in the world, in the real world, rather than academia. So I'm a full-time academic, and I'm on what's known as the teaching route. So I research isn't expected from me, and actually, you know, I do quite a lot of teaching hours, so it's quite hard to do any anyway. So. And I, as part of my role, I have a half a day a week role as what's known as a lead for teaching excellence within my school, and that's around mentoring, coaching, and supporting early career academics, for example, with applications for Higher Education Academy fellowship, that kind of thing. Yeah, I think in terms of, so that's what I do, and I suppose very quickly, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but, you know, for me, I feel my job is that students come along, and I teach on a whole range of programs, clinical and non-clinical. I'm not a clinician, my background is social sciences. I feel I try to, I think when I spend time with students, it's very different. It's more about sort of trying to develop critical thinking rather than facts. And, you know, I think Mark referred to, you know, the syringe this morning, and, you know, putting the syringe in the right place and in the right way. So mine is more, I feel it's much more for me around developing, supporting and working with students as to develop critical thinking skills. That's my job, my day-to-day job. So I hope that sort of answered a little bit about the space I occupy, learning, teaching.
I would like to.
Thanks.
Thank you. Sorry, I was hoping you could do that. Can you hear me okay? Brilliant. So,
hi everyone, my name is Abby Buckley. I am a lecturer in criminology at the Open University. And I think this event, I'm really grateful actually to be here, and I feel really privileged because I finally had a bit of time at the end of the year to actually kind of think back and reflect. And think, like that first question around how, what type of spaces we occupy and how these might be queer or not. So I think for us today, I have put together something like a list of three different spaces that I think I do occupy. So firstly, just to get to know each other a little bit more, I'm starting with something a bit personal. So similarly, so I have been a member of an LGBT peer support organization since 2010, so for the last 8 years, and I'm currently a volunteer mentor, mentoring non-binary, genderqueer and trans people, and I think that's extremely important for me. Secondly, in terms of the second space, which kind of relates to the first one in a way, my teaching is directly linked to queer. I have taught across a wide variety of different modules, from criminal law, property law, and also criminology, victimology, and research methods, so kind of all out there. And I have also taught across a wide variety of institutions. So I started at the LNC, then I moved to Birkbeck, then to Teesside University, and currently I'm at the OU. And at the OU, I currently lead a postgraduate module that is called Crime and Global Justice. And I have queered that as much as I could. So I teach as part of that feminist and queer theory in order to think about justice, and also feminist criminology and queer criminology. Thirdly, in terms of research, I'm part of three different research projects that kind of play around with the concept of queer. And the first one is called Queer Victims, and actually looks into gender violence affecting specifically queer communities. And it brings together two different things. On the one hand, structural harms like ableism, xenophobia, transphobia, homophobia, all sorts of prejudice and discrimination. And on the other hand, interpersonal violence, so kind of violence against a person between one person or many. I have also been part of a project that seeks to expand queer criminology, and that could be either theoretical, kind of what it means to be a queer criminologist, what does it do, but also methodologically in many different ways. And as part of the discussion for this panel, we have been encouraged to think about Cruising Utopia and Muñoz. And Muñoz describes the importance of queer in the forms of elliptic and almost fragmented speech. And I believe yesterday poetry was kind of at the core of things. So while someone might argue that that last project is not quite queer, it's actually about poetic harm and representations of harm in poetry. I think Muñoz would actually push us to think otherwise for that. So these are the three spaces that I think could be described as queer for the time being. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm Stephanie Davis from UEL University of London. I'm a lecturer in psychology, and I'm an early career researcher, so I'm in my kind of second year of teaching. So UEL itself is a really exciting place because it's majority Black, Asian, minority ethnic students, majority first generation and working class. So it's an exciting kind of place to do quite interesting, potentially radical work, I think. And for me, yes, I'm interested in, I think I'm really grateful for the spaces that Jennifer creates for us here and around our critical pedagogies group, because for me there's an ongoing tension around how to do critical work and using critical pedagogy within a kind of neoliberal university how to continue to do kind of anti-oppressive work while at the same time pressures of democratisation of higher education. So my work at UEL, I've done a little bit of work around employability, which I felt very ambivalent about, I think. But also I'm teaching a module on psychology and activism, where I'm definitely going to be querying that up. And also a praxis module for community psychology, in which we're getting students to engage with community projects and evaluate community projects. And also have an ongoing working project with a colleague around decoloniality. So how do we think about decolonizing academia and psychology, and also around decolonizing disease? That's a research interest at the moment. So for me, there's a constant question of decolonizing and working with students to resist some of the difficulties of working in higher education. So I'm looking forward to talk about that today. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dibya Shanand. I'm from the host university, University of Westminster. In fact, I was just listening to the term you occupy in learning and teaching. And my own work is challenging occupation of India, so occupation of Kashmir by India, occupation of Tibet by China, and all those things. So I always get anxious when I look at the word occupy, because they have different meanings. So when we had Occupy protests, of course there were different kinds of occupation compared to the kind of occupation like I research on. That itself, of course, raises the questions of the terms we use, the identities we embrace, the identity we challenge. So in my own work, for instance, as an introduction to myself, well, professionally I'm a professor here at the university. I'm head of Department of Politics and IR, which Tom is part. And I'll be working with other colleagues in psychology, criminology, sociology, and politics and international relations as the new School of Social Sciences from 1st of August. And when our new Vice Chancellor, he asked me one question, which is around our building. So one building we are based in Well Street, is quite a dull building, let me put it that way. Now he said, you know, you are so colorful, but I think I'm colorful, but you are so colorful, but the building isn't. So what would be your flag? Now, I imagine a rainbow flag. I know one could queer the rainbow flag also, but I said rainbow flag. Because sometimes we still have to appropriate something that's being appropriated by, let's say, capitalism or by the state or homo-nationalism. So I said queer flag, right? I said rainbow flag, but that's how I say it, queer flag. The reason I mentioned this is because one idea and I have to work with all of you possibly is to make that new school into something that's not only queer friendly, but really queer in every way possible. And really queer in the sense also what we'll be talking of intersectionality and other things later. Now in my own work, or in my own identity, in fact the only identity I've embraced is of being queer. Other identities I inhabit is something I would be seen and born with, or I would inherit or something. So I didn't choose. So I did not choose to be cis male in certain contexts. I did not choose to belong to certain caste. I do not choose to belong to a certain class, and most of these identities are identities of privilege. So I'm someone who in UK context one would say, oh, BME, black minority ethnic, and therefore not privileged. But the way I see is my life has been of privileges of various kinds, coming from India, coming here, but having schooling and university education that was seen as very privileged. The only, and in fact, but my work has been largely around challenging privileges, and in a way solidarity with those who are occupied, oppressed, minoritized. And when people ask me, why do you work so much on that, the only answer I could come up with, oh, I'm queer, right? So in a way queer allowed me to challenge things more easily, challenge nationalism, challenge misogyny, challenge homophobia, of course, queer phobia and everything else. Now in my own research, and I go back to research and teaching, is in terms of, I have worked significantly for 20 years now on Tibet, Chinese occupation of Tibet, Western imagination of Tibet. I've worked on Islamophobia in India and the gross kind of fascist nationalism that's taking place in India. I've worked on security related matters, but not security in terms of how the states can secure itself, but how states use security in order to dehumanize population. That's the kind of work I do. And my professorial lecture last year, was it last year? I don't even know when it was. Was it?
It was this year.
Oh, it was. No, I think last year. It was last year. And last year was on queering the self, decolonizing the state and those kind of things. So I work on intersectionality. In terms of learning and teaching, I'm someone who strongly believes that the whole divide between research, teaching, admin, leadership, all those things are again artificial, the ways in which university or neoliberal universities seek to manage us, while letting us believe that we are managing ourselves, right? So in my own ways, though I'm a bureaucrat, of course, because I'm head of department, so it's a bureaucratic position, is try my level best to even queer that role. And the allies I find, of course, are colleagues, but more important, students. So when I identified or went public about my queer identity, that wasn't long ago, I'm 41, so it's, I'm quite in terms of age, but I only acknowledged to myself around 6 years ago and went public around 3 to 4 years ago. And a significant role there was played by the students, who have felt that our students, who are like students at your university and possibly your university, right, are those who in UK context again are seen as, oh, not very queer friendly. So the idea, you know, in UK there's always, oh, Muslims versus queer. So there's always this idea that you challenge Islamophobia, then if you challenge Islamophobia somehow, then you are being something else. The way I saw was that our students were the biggest allies I had in acknowledging myself and coming out with them, and in a way also encouraging them to be themselves, right? So that's how I see myself, which I haven't answered fully, but you know, that's me. Thank you.
Can I borrow the microphone?
Oh, sure.
I didn't mention this, but there's actually copies of the questions on the table in case, because the next one has a quote. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with José Esteban Muñoz's book, Cruising Utopia, but it's been quite influential in my thinking around how we queer things, especially how we queer the relations of learning and teaching. And so we posed this question to our panelists in advance. So in that book, Munoz argues that we may never touch queerness, but we can feel it as the warm illumination of a horizon imbued with potentiality. Queerness is that thing that lets us feel that this world is not enough, that indeed something is missing. Queerness is essentially about the rejection of a here and now, and an insistence on potentiality or concrete possibility for another world. And so the thing we asked you to think about was that thinking expansively about the horizon of queerness, what might queering learning and teaching entail? Who would like the mic? Avi?
Go first. So, in order to start thinking along the lines of Cruising Utopia, I have a very brief story for us. So on June 9th, just earlier this month, basically the Athens Pride, the Athens Greece LGBT Pride took place, and the parade was presented as something extremely successful this year. So it was presented as, you know, kind of that big parade, about 60,000 people, I think, attended. And for Greece to think about the parade during the time of austerity, that was a really big event, and also an event of political but also diplomatic importance. So it was represented as an event where, I think, diplomats from 32 countries attended. So it was presented that big, important political celebration. In many ways, the Pride was then linked to Greece's capacity to protect minority rights more generally, especially in the context of the so-called refugee crisis. And therefore, as a positive kind of positive step for Greece's future in many ways. To give you a bit of a personal context, I left Greece in 2006, I'm Greek, and the Athens Pride actually started in 2005. Where basically just 500 people attended. So to have that comparison, you know, 13 years later, that is 60,000 people, it's actually quite amazing. So this year, the main theme, the main slogan involved the word present, parousa, and this means in that context, you know, of course, that I'm present in this struggle, in this celebration, in this voice, in this parade, I'm present, but present was used in the feminine form, as if the person stating present was actually a woman in this context. And this was meant to celebrate femininity or femininities and subvert the ways in which, especially in Greek, hegemonic masculinity has colonized in many different ways the language. So every time you actually need to say something in gender neutral ways, you would use the masculine pronouns. I will leave aside for the time being that quite a lot of controversial comments were made about how exclusionary perhaps that was, especially for people who have fought really hard in Greece to establish their masculine pronouns. However, what I would like us to consider very, very briefly is the fact that while that big celebration, big parade was taking place, another parade was also taking place, and it was quite unexpected. And it was no other than the Straight Pride. Driven by straight people, I have some lovely pictures for us that I can show you actually. Driven by straight people who felt that gay pride erases straight experiences. So while the Straight Pride is taking place, it is, I think, very important for us to consider in classrooms queerness as a structuring and educated mode, following Munoz, to desire a different future. So in doing so, it is important to use queerness as a focus on the present, the now, the failures of the present, and here I'm quoting almost Halberstam, the negative, the melancholy, in the work of Douglas Green perhaps, but also the utopia, the longing, the rejection of a here and now, the rejection of a straight pride, and the possibility for another world. So as Munoz puts it, this is not to say that we need to be optimistic. Queer is not about being just optimistic. But following Munoz, queering learning and teaching is twofold. So I'll just focus on these two different things. So first of all, queering learning and teaching engages with a critique of current practices, right? A critique of current practices that fuels critical and also potentially transformative discourses and actions. For instance, queer enables us in a classroom to question what that straight pride may mean, what it does, what symbolic places it occupies or colonizes, what struggles it aims to obliterate, and also what type of histories it aims to hijack in many different ways. It also secondly creates spaces of collective resistance and struggle. So it creates the hopes of a collective, of an emergent group, and as Munoz puts it, concrete utopias are the realm of educated hope, which I think is something that I love hearing about. Shall I pass it on?
So I absolutely love this quote. It was, yeah, it, for me, reading it, it just makes you think about blackness and race and about the kind of the need to survive and that there must be another world that's possible. And yeah, the rejection of the here and now, that's always the state that black people post, or during slavery and post-slavery have lived. And it really made me think about Alexis Pauline Gums. I don't know if you know her work. She's a black feminist and an educator. And she talks about fugitivity and about Harriet Tubman talking during slavery about, she said, my people are free, even within slavery, like my people are free. And that as a as a phrase to be thinking about, what was Harriet Tubman thinking at that point? She was thinking about the future that was possible. And Alexis Pauline Gums thinking through how the past and the future, perhaps not in a linear way, but are already together, and how we're influencing ourselves and each other, and that possibility for the future, which I think is really powerful. And I think for me, my research, my PhD research is around queer, trans, people of colour, activist communities, and around being queerly raised, and that otherness, that experience of otherness, that is queerness, right? And that need for collective action together to negotiate that. So yeah, that that brings up a lot for me in thinking about how we work with students to think about their position in the world. And it's we're not just talking about abstract rejection of the here and now, but a real, it's rooted in survival. We need to know that there is another world possible for our actual survival. That's why I'm very excited about being at UEL, because the students there respond really well to things around decolonizing academia, and really relate it to their experience in education. So thinking about, so when I did a lecture on decolonizing academia, I had students saying to me, that has been the elephant in the room my whole educational experience. No one will talk about race. It's completely ignored, and it was very powerful to have that moment with students. But also, on the other hand, there was also a backlash from other students who didn't want to hear about decolonizing academia. And there's a tension definitely with psychology, that some students want to learn psychology, the master's tools, I suppose. And so they don't want me to come in and be critiquing and asking them to engage with other possibilities. So I think that's an ongoing tension for me about like queering academic space. Some students really value it and others, yeah, really don't. So yeah, I'd like to talk more about that with all of you as well. Thank you.
In terms of, okay, the previous question, I forgot to say something that actually I identify myself primarily as a student. Student in the sense that on issues relating to queer theory, queer, not queer identity, but queer theory and queer politics, I'm still learning. I'm learning from you all. I'm learning from workshops such as this. So always we have to bear that in mind, that it's a constant process of learning. So when we think of, let's say, queering education, learning and teaching, and I'm using the word education more expansively, first and foremost, what this quote reminds us is of the radical uncertainty and the lack of closure. So the way I see is being queer or practicing queer politics or practicing learning and teaching is about process rather than end product. That's something which I learned about it. It is about subversion. It is about subverting dominant ways in which the societies have been structured. So dominant ways, of course, go along with violence. Dominant ways be around the ideas of nation state. They might be around ideas of race, around ideas of sexuality. So in a way, if one acknowledges, inhabits, and practices queer politics and identity, one cannot not look at other forms of structuring of the society through violence. So that's what I learned from this quote and think about it. It is also about identity. So for instance, it's one thing to say that everything is uncertain, which it is. Let's say for instance, nations are bad, nationalism is bad, flags are bad. But saying to Palestinians or saying to Tibetans or Kurdish people or Kashmiri people that, oh, you should not struggle for the nation because nations are oppressive is not right, given that the dominant political vocabulary of expression in the world remains that of nation state. So we have to always bear in mind that when we ask a question and ask and scrutinize whether we acknowledge asymmetry of power or not. So in this case also, in one sense, we have to acknowledge that for a lot of queer people in the world, of different kinds of queer people, the struggle to be identified, struggle to be legalized itself is a big struggle. Right? So they are not in a position to just challenge that part. Sometimes you could say that, oh well, for instance, same-sex marriage, it's a conservative institution, marriage is a conservative institution, and I always say that, well, marriage is, I don't know what's the right word, so pardon me, but it's not stupid, it's the right word, but you know, it's a problematic institution. But let's say, queer people have as much right to be problematic as the straight people would be, therefore it should be allowed. Now, we need to discuss that here, but in other parts of the world, some parts of the world, even the acknowledgement that they exist itself is and the question. So we have to bear in mind differences that exist. Sorry, I move my hands a lot, so I'll just try to balance it. Now, in terms of, when you look at the quote, it's also about survival. For many, it is about surviving. Surviving as queer person, surviving queer person of color, surviving as queer racialized person, surviving as queer person with forms of disability. So it's a question of survival, that's how I see it. It reminds me, the quote, partly of a corporeality. I was thinking of body. Body is at the heart of various things we do. At the same time, the quote reminded me of the ideas of idealism. Not idealism in philosophical sense, but idealism in the sense of working towards something which we may not have and which we may not get. But still we have to work towards it. So in that sense, for me, queer radicalism provides that option of struggle for something that's grounded, but at the same time, that is beyond what's grounded, something based on fantasy, something based on dream. It is also in the end acknowledging that we'd always be anxious, we'd always be in doubt, we'd never have a firm answer, and often remind us students that the only ones who have firm answers are the fascists. Fascism, the, let's say, fascism, I'm sure favorite punctuation mark would be the full stop, right? On the other hand, if we, let's say, practice, inhabit queer identity in politics, it is about exclamation mark sometimes, but often the question mark. So for, let's say, an identity and practice that has been criminalized, that has been marginalized, that has been dehumanized for long periods of time, what we can learn from it and what we have to practice, of course, is to look at other forms of identity that face similar kinds of, let's say, operation of power and work intersectionally, which is the next question I know, on challenging it. But as I said, this is in the end about acknowledging that it would remain a struggle forever. I'm giving a form.
Sorry, let me put my glasses on and off. Those are all fantastic replies. It's quite sort of scary glass. The quote, so Mignotti's quote, I think for me one of the things that I wanted to pick up from that was this concept of potentiality, and I'll come back to that. But I said earlier that I work in a school of health sciences, and that means
that there are professional bodies involved, all the clinical professional bodies, the National Midwifery Council, all those various sort of professional bodies overseeing and constantly scrutinising the programmes. So the idea of being able to reject a here and now and think about potentiality and subversion and rejections of established norms, etc., I find quite challenging when trying to think about queering health studies education. Students want to know how to do a particular thing in a way that will be recognised and in their professional body, and be able to talk about those. So the way that they're assessed it ranges hugely from written stuff, but they have these clinical stations that they have to go around, and that involves a clinical skill, but it also involves a dynamic between them and the patient, whether it's a real patient or a simulated patient. And so, they have their things, as all students have, haven't they? They've got their thing that they know they need to pass. They've got these things that they absolutely have to do. So I find it really quite challenging thinking about, how do I do that. And I think it was really nice to have, to have the quote and be thinking about this. We had these questions a little while ago, didn't we? And sort of thinking about sort of things about how I do that and how I could do that, or how maybe other people could do that. I could work with other people in doing that. And I think I started getting into less talking about sort of theory, but more thinking about practicalities. And I think one of the things that for me as an individual working within, as a person that I talked about and I positioned myself earlier, and thinking about the kind of students who I work with, similar to I think probably most people here, our students are mostly BAME, across our programmes. I'm there as a teacher, as a white individual. It's already, having to pay attention to those things, and I think I often do position myself when I meet a new group. Sometimes that's really hard when you have 50 minutes to do a lecture on diversity. I mean, that's just upset. That's just not possible to do that. But so that's the sort of situation that we're in. So for me, and in terms of the practical methods, I think I went to that. Is how can I actually do that? I felt that sort of using the sort of language that I use, paying close attention to the language that I use, but what the language that other students use with each other, with me. The kind of images that I use, the kinds of examples that I use, paying close attention to those all the time. You've got stories, what other different sort of materials, anything that moves away from binary stereotypes. And try to work with students and see and think about learning as a journey that we're doing together. So of course paying attention to the power within the room, power in terms of my power as the person responsible for them passing. Let's face it, that's what we're having to do all the time. And how I do that and how they convince me that that they are, that they are appropriate to be able to be registered with this professional body. So it feels incredibly, I find it really, really challenging sometimes. I think that, Kamoshira talks about, paying close attention as a queer educator to what you do as a teacher, but also what you do as a colleague and what you do as a researcher. So I know we picked up that some of those things came up yesterday. And I think for me, it's about trying to, as I said earlier about developing critical thinking,
developing critical thinking as an individual, but challenging everything. So for example, we're having to give students data a lot of the time, from all sorts of places, data that's been collected. And so, you know, I think, how can I query data? And so I think for me, one of the things I do is, you know, whenever I present data, we break it down as to who's collected this data, where's it been published, how has it been collected, you know, who by all that. So interrogating that at that level. And I think that then we see how, you know, the truth of the data actually doesn't really exist. It exists in a particular form, you know, floating out there. It's something they have to engage with. But I think doing that from the very beginning of students' programs, actually, as we sort of work with students, we sort of see them questioning that more and more as we go through questioning the literature. So asking students to question everything that they read, you know, everything that they do, obviously that they've got to do practical clinical things, but sometimes that also is really important. You know, who is it that, you know, where did that evidence come from that this is the way one should do this? You know, who is it that came up with that evidence in the first place, and what were their methods? And so that can happen all the way through, from theoretical to practical. And yeah, constantly asking students to question taken for granted knowledge. And it's really interesting, again, thinking earlier around citation practices and who they cite and how they cite them, and challenging all those kinds of things, and trying to get students to think about that differently. And so it's really, really exciting to hear a bit more about that earlier. And we're sort of still thinking about how can do that much more. So I think for me, so practical things like that, using getting students to think about personal stories, what things mean in their own lives, placing clinical experiences and clinical tasks that they need to learn, but placing those within their own lived experiences, and what does that mean? So using stories and clinical scenarios from people can come, you know, we ask a student to come up with their own stories that they can then work through together. So much more problem-based learning rather than facts and biology. So, you know, use Play-Doh quite a lot, you know, so things like that they can then talk to each other about, rather than not talk about the actual item, but what it might mean for them, what it means in terms of their lived experiences, etc. So for me, I think I'm still on a journey with this, and when I talk to students, I say, you know, I feel like I often learn as much from you as I hope that we're learning together and you're learning from each other. And I think they're sometimes a little bit fazed by that. Now, some students find that, you know, as you said, Stephanie, you know, some students engage with being challenged in really different ways, and some respond really well, and some don't engage at all. And sometimes I find that very, very challenging, really challenging, actually. And have I failed? You know, how that makes me feel. And so I spend a lot of time reflecting after a difficult class. I spend quite a lot of time sort of thinking about, you know, what could I have done differently, and how could I have engaged them more? Should I have used better technology? Should I have used, you know, other methods? You know, how can I do that in a way that, you know, it sounds like I'm making it all about myself, but the particular bit is about myself, because I think that's a really important thing to reflect on as a teacher. So yeah, sorry, that's a bit incoherent, but I think those are my thoughts that I was trying to gather together.
Should I start the third question?
Could you read it and then go? That would be great.
So the third question is, if we think about queer as a social and political project, then we can't think about it in isolation from other sites of oppression. How might we engage in questions of intersectionality when we are queering, learning and teaching? I just want to respond actually to what you were saying, Raph, about those difficult teaching experiences. And I think I struggle as a new lecturer. I've been told that some students think I have an agenda around race, gender and sexuality. It's like, well, that's my research, and yes, we all have agendas, I suppose. but that I've been, I felt shamed by that, and so then it's made me question, well, am I trying to put something onto students that they don't want, and you know, what is my role? So yeah, so that's been very difficult for me to navigate. Thank you. So yeah, so these spaces are so valuable for me to sort of share and work with other people in this. I suppose thinking about engaging in questions of intersectionality for me, that's me. That's where I am. So I'm always conscious of intersectionality and trying to get my students to engage with it a lot more. So in any work that I do in psychology, it's always a push. And again, with colleagues, some colleagues are really receptive and others are not. So yeah, encouraging that. I suppose I'm not sure I've got as coherent ideas because I feel like it's just what I do. But maybe more practical strategies I was thinking of was encouraging research with students. So I have a really great colleague, Rachel Liebert at UEL, and she just inspires me all the time because she's always getting students to do research with her or as part of their masters around questioning things like academia, looking at decolonising. So she had a group of master's students, 9 students who did a project together on decolonising UEL, and which, you know, ruffled some feathers perhaps, but was really exciting to the students. Students were really concerned about certain things at UEL and wanted to address them around intersectionality and decolonising. So getting students to realise that they can do that work and actually being, I don't like the word empowered, but empowered to realise that they are like knowledge creators as well. Just encouraging them in that. And also engaging students with community projects. So I'm in community psychology, so getting students to work with community organisations. And as part of the psychology and activism module, we're going to be looking at different strands of liberation struggles, kind of around race, economic justice and gender, but it will be intersectional, so intersectional thread throughout. And so really getting students to engage in local community liberation struggles. And then also another question, I think I missed yesterday, unfortunately, because I had to be at work for another engagement, but I think about being myself with students and sort of recognising each other and our intersectional differences and honouring those. I feel it's really powerful the way we connect with our students, and particularly at our universities, I think there is a place for students to see academics in a different way. So when I first started at UEL, I had students saying, if I think of a PhD, I think of a white man. And so you saying that you have a PhD is so exciting, and to show that academia can be for people from all walks of life, can be intersectional, and so that's exciting for me. And at some points in my career so far, I've been uncertain about how much of me I can bring into a classroom, but now more and more I'm feeling much more comfortable to be fully myself, fully a like queer black woman in the room, and to encourage students to be with themselves in the classroom. And then also another thing about intersectionality and queer in learning and teaching is about resisting and questioning university practices. So what the university does, what the services do, and how that impacts students and staff, and finding kind of connections intersectionally across the staff and the student body, which I found really important to do. And yeah, I think for me, there about sharing and recognising our shared otherness between staff and students is really powerful, and not just about the content, but the way we are together in the lecture space.
The certain pattern we are following.
Yes, we are.
The next one I read, I have to start first. In terms of, again, like the whole idea that some forget the colleagues. Colleagues may also think you have agenda, you see. So, but some students think, oh, you have agenda, and sometimes we find in student feedback, oh, our academics are too left-wing, that's what we find. And I find that good, by the way. They say too left-wing, or they don't provide all perspectives and everything. And that's part and parcel of teaching, learning environment we are in. In a way, we can never adhere to everyone's expectation, and that's fine, right? So long as the idea, they feel comfortable to express that. Now, one challenge I had, and that was a year ago, was I did a lecture on, and I found that when I've spoken about, let's say, gender or sexuality, I've not had that much of challenge or resistance. It's around race that I get it really. So you could talk of other things, but around race, it gets really uncomfortable or very comfortable. So it's quite divided there. So I've experienced students who felt that by talking in favor of migration or by talking against anti-immigrantism, in a way, I was not respecting their anxieties about how black, brown people coming to Europe is going to lead to women suffering in Europe, those kind of things, right? And that's where you get in difficult situations. So if it was a colleague, I could sort of respond more firmly. But if it's a student, so there is an asymmetry of power. So I'm a professor, that's a student, and that student is expressing what's clearly a neo-Nazi viewpoint to me. And I can't say you are neo-Nazi because you're a student, so I have to also be take care of that. And that I find slightly challenging, more challenging than other things. I'll say, okay, we have to respect all different viewpoints when I know that his viewpoint is actually going to deny identity to 60% of us. But you have to always negotiate. So what I've learned is, in one way, is confront but also negotiate, and sometimes just leave it, hoping that the person will change, and sometimes people do change. So one beauty of education, when we teach people, students, we realize is they come up with very clear ideas, and okay, we are not that different. We come with clear ideas, and after 2-3 years, they change. So for instance, I have interacted with other kinds of students. One student who could, very deeply religious student, who felt that not only being queer is against religion, but interacting with a queer person is also somehow not right, except that I am the professor, so he has to interact with me. And I did say that your culture in this context, what does it teach? Respecting teachers. So now your culture teaches respect teachers, but your, according to you, your religion teaches don't speak to queer, so how will you negotiate? So now one thing I've learned, and I would say it again, how to engage in question intersections, to talk. A particular experience I have had with British liberal system, right? I'm not talking right-wing system, I don't want to interact with them. Liberal system is around silence. So anything that comes uncomfortable, keep silent. My approach so far has been to talk about it. Be open to it, even be open to someone who's dehumanizing you and rejecting your identity. Because talking helps. Not always, but often it helps. So I did think that is there. So intersectionality for us, I'm sure for many of us, when we talk of ourselves as, let's say, queer and white, the moment we say white, even though it's a privileged identity, we highlight intersectionality. So that's something we do through our research. This is something we should do through our teaching. The problem, of course, in a neoliberal setup is that neoliberal, you can use it. So the way I see is, we have to negotiate with it, right? So sometimes you have to use it. So neoliberal universities would expect diversity to be respected, because that's the law. So let's use that language of diversity, which we will not agree with, because we know it's domesticating. But use it in order to get what we want. So a few years ago, when I was being interviewed for my previous role, and I could sense that some would want me because, of course, that tick box, right? The only brown, black, whatever, non-white is the term I use, head of department, so it's a good thing. Except, and I did say that, you know, you can use my identity the way you want to, but I will use my identity the way I want to. So you can use my identity as Indian, black, brown, whatever you want, but I'm going to use it in terms of a politics of identity that's going to be subversive. So that's in a way pact one does with the neoliberal setup, and one could do it. Intersectionality, how do we engage? It's through ourselves. It is through our everyday politics. And vis-a-vis students and colleagues, be very clear. I know it's being recorded, so I don't mind it. I had written 2 months ago, tweeted about it, of how, now, by the way, I don't tweet about our university as such, right? I mean, I don't name universities, I never name people. I name fascists, you know, I can name Erdogan or May or Trump, that's different. But normally I would never say anything about people, I don't do that. But I've just written that UK universities are very diverse in terms of senior management. Straight white men, male straight white, then I use all combination of straight white male to say how diverse university senior management is. Right? Now, I had a colleague coming to me next day saying to me that, oh, you know, I hope you are not upset with me. I said, why? Or you don't hate me. I said, why would I hate you? You know, because I'm straight white male. Now, that's a kind of, you know, passive aggressive or microaggression we interact with in everyday life. Many of us would have done it. And my responsibility was, well, I know it's a bit aggressive, but I said, well, I only write against those who have more power than me. You don't. Now, that's a professor. By the way, no, he's a professor. It's not that he's a professor. But that's how I have to do it. Sometimes you have to stand up to bullies is how I see it, right? But highlighting that is we do experience in our own ways, I'm sure, microaggression, passive aggressive, where we think, is it us who are wrong? I mean, are they saying it to me? A few years ago, again, when I was new head of department at a particular gathering, someone said, oh, so what happened to Roland, who was the previous head? Oh, he's now the dean. So who's the new head of department? Someone said, oh, it's Dibya. She's such a great change. He said, oh, like Obama. Now, he said like Obama, and I thought, okay, no, I couldn't say anything immediately because a lot of time we don't know how to respond. I would love to, not in terms of bombing and drone attacks, but no, at least when I don't mind being compared to Obama. But in that context, I knew what it meant. But it took me 2 days of thinking in order to then get back, not to that person, because they would say, oh, well, you know, I didn't mean it. So we have to face that in everyday level, around race, around gender and sexuality. But in my case, in the UK university context, it has not been around sexuality. It has almost always been around race slash ethnicity. So the way I do is through research, through being myself, even an open day and applicant day, if, well, you're not coming because you're not going to be students with us, but open day applicant, I'm very clear about my identity, politics and politics, including queer identity. And that, I know, makes some colleagues slightly uncomfortable because they think, what if parents don't like that? But I said, if they don't like it, that's their problem. Because, and I say to you that it's not parents' choice, it's your choice, right? You choose what it is. And I know that it works vis-a-vis students. So in terms of race, ethnicity, various forms of abilities, various forms of gender, race, all kinds of identity, the way is to be ourselves as much as possible, be open to being questioned. And I have been questioned, and I have learned, right? For me, the pronoun of they, them, and I thought, what does it mean? It took me some time in order to think, and I remember using the word she, and then thinking, but what's the big deal? Then it took me, I don't know, over 2-3 days to think what it was, and then what I was doing. What I was doing was saying that just because it's not important to me, I'm assuming it's not important to them. So self-reflexivity, humility, all these are part and parcel of how we learn. And the reality, of course, is we cannot have a queer-friendly world until and unless we have also a world that is respectful for and supportive of, in terms of solidarity, struggles that are taking place around other issues, be it nationality, gender, race, and everything else. So in essence, we do that in everyday life. And I know I'll keep other answers for the next question. Thank you. I keep giving you a phone.
Thank you. Glasses on.
Those are really fantastic answers. So I think I'm very moved by the by how much both of you talked about the importance of being yourself, and I think I touched on that a little bit earlier, and talking about humility and your personal politics and questioning and being open to being questioned. I think those are incredibly important. So for me, that's sort of part of it. You know, part of intersectionality. So I'm sort of thinking, when thinking about this question, I think, what am I trying to do in the classroom, in addition to what I've already said? So thinking about deconstructing identities, dismantling hierarchies, thinking about how social and political categories are established and maintained, and how those work and how those shape power relations, and how they shape people's experiences, day-to-day experiences, and you know, and create oppression on a day-to-day level. So trying to think about that, and working with students and thinking about trying to see. It sort of links a little bit to the previous question, you know, trying to think about a world, is there a world where, you know, is it possible to have a world where people's differences, and that no particular difference is more valued than any other? So I think for you know, challenging those kinds of things. And when I was thinking about this particular question, one of a particular group of students that I just started teaching this year came to mind. And I'm running this new module called Poverty, Housing and Welfare on a new BSc program. And all the students are 18, just fresh out of school. Mostly, I would say there's one student out of 30, I think, in the group. And they live at home with their parents. Some of them, they are quite rigidly controlled in the way that they're being able to come to, the university is the only place they can come to, and they're, you know, that's their timing, they have to be home. If they come for a tutorial, they've got to be really clear about timings. So for me, trying to think about those and how we interact with each other. So, and they've, as I said, they just come out of school, being in university is a completely new thing for them. So they're in that transitional phase from school, being called Miss, which is a horrific, traumatic thing to be called, and being asked to go to the toilet, and from all of those kinds of things. And I found this group the most challenging group of students I've ever worked with, ever, in my entire sort of teaching career. It's been, so I've spent a lot of time talking with colleagues about it and reflect on it, written blogs in our own university about it. Several of you have touched on, you know, presenting your own politics and, you know, how people see that. But I feel very clearly that, like you all, that's my agenda, and, you know, I'm really sorry, this is it. You know, in this particular module, we have to talk about, you know, poverty, capital, you know, and there's very specific things. You know, I don't know how one can present, talk about that without being political. We talk about, you know, welfare, we're talking about housing, and, you know, and I'm sorry if this is a difficult subject for anybody in the room, but we talk about Grenfell a lot as a real case study. And I think that the timing of that, and the of the fire, and the timing of the movement and the resistance and the search for justice and everything associated with that, I think it's been a really good case study for students to be thinking about all those elements and power, and, you know, who has the power, and much far more than any sort of theorist that I could talk about, or do occasionally talk about or ask them to read about. We'll talk later about how we use that work around that, a particular case study later. But I think for me, talking about, you know, who I am and where I come from, and encouraging them to do the same, and then hearing students that then talking about, you know, one student said, I'm not sure if I'm a refugee or I'm an immigrant. So we were sort of exploring that, and they said, I think I'm the child of an immigrant, but I'm not sure. Understanding I mentioned that earlier, the sort of language that we're using, and then introducing concepts to students that they can then go away and think about themselves, and the bedroom tax, and then thinking about how that affects them and their own dad, and they didn't understand why they had to move to a smaller place, and then suddenly being able to understand that and the politics around that. So I think for me, it's about practical examples and being oneself and being true to myself. I'm sorry, everyone said so much fantastic stuff. It's hard to add, you know, there's things that I'm crossing off that have already been said. Sorry. Thank you.
Sorry.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. So I think I have to apologize just because I took the question to mean something else.
That's great. That's fantastic.
And I took it in a more, I think, abstract
way, in a more abstract sense, in terms of what queer theory, what is the relationship between queer theory and intersectionality in some ways. I think there I see a tension. I think that this is not a very straightforward relationship. And on the one hand, I completely identify with the previous speakers in terms of queer theory has at its core intersectional struggles, right? That's at the very core of what queer theory is about, coming together and creating a new space for struggle. On the other hand, queer theory takes on the form of very various things, risks, ambitions, ambivalences. It's a very ambivalent space. To the extent that it's impossible to denote a stable referential content, right? So we can't really say, we can't put a finger on this one content, on this one example, this one practice, and say, this is what queer is about. It seems that it always becomes a space, opens up a different space of ambivalence every time we try to engage with a term. So if we apply this tension between, yes, kind of a certain relationship between queer and intersectionality, and also this other bit that is always ambivalent and open and up for negotiation, then I think two points are worth considering here altogether. The first one is following Foucault that queer draws on post-structuralism in many different ways. Specifically in the way that the self is socially constructed and constituted, and this is something that we've been talking about, how our self is constructed in classrooms, and also the other way around, our students' self is always constructed as well. For post-structuralism, the way that discourses produce subjectivities are at the very core of the maintenance of power, and here I have an example for us. So if we normalize the harms, I don't know if you have followed the case with a whale that was found dead with 30 different plastic bags in the stomach. So if we normalize those environmental harms, then we come at a place where we don't quite see how these harms are being reproduced and perpetuated. And for instance, we might think, we're not going to, but we might think, or someone might think, that Donald Trump is a nice guy who just happens to ignore environmental harms and so forth. But in effect, this has an impact on who we are becoming, and also has an impact on how we position ourselves within a space of inequalities, because I think this is what we're talking about, how we position ourselves among and against inequalities. Secondly, beyond the focus on the self and subjectivities, which I think is important, when it comes to considering wider structures, then intersectionality, the way it meets queer, pushes the things about structures. So here we can consider, and these points were all touched upon, the ongoing economic crisis, unemployment, growing inequalities, the rise of right political powers, the traps of the neoliberal university and individualism, and also capitalist competition at the very end, right? This is the underlying source in a sense. So we can consider the fact that we are pushed to think, all of us, as a group divided by identity politics in many ways and hierarchies, which is, I think, the points that have been mentioned here. So I think using and utilizing queer meaningfully means that we need to come together, we need to be united in respectful and also transformative actions, which I think brings us to the next question. So it was all very... Sorry, I just realized that there was...
That's great. So you could pose question four and start.
Yeah. Shall I?
Yes, that would be fantastic.
So, what might be practical strategies or methods for us to queer learning and teaching? And if I am to start, I think I'll be really brief, really. So, I have noted down two different points. So, the first one is that teaching needs to include political actions. So, for instance, when in the recent strikes, we briefly talked about that, against the casualization of people and pensions, students joined us in picket lines. And I think this, exactly there, was the point where a new space opened up and continues to be opening. Similarly, when the protests for the tuition fees were taking place in 2010, we all, again, came together because it was that realization that what is at stake, or yes, was and is at stake in these struggles is higher education as a whole. The second point that I have jotted down is that teaching and learning needs to be participatory, transformative, and non-oppressive. And I think that idea of
non-oppression that is at the heart of queer needs to be even closer to that heart. So a capitalist market-driven teaching and learning is by definition oppressive, I think. It forces us to occupy very specific, certain positions that are already there for us to occupy, and it closes down our imagination, our creativity, and ultimately our ability to resist multiple oppressive powers that operate at the same time, which goes back to that intersectionality that we're talking about. So I encourage us to come together, think, plan, and join forces with.
Thank you for that. That was, I want to kind of talk a bit more about that as well, about the participatory, definitely. I think encouraging students and encouraging staff to engage more together, a little bit what I was talking about, my colleague Rachel Lieber and community psychology, it's really about applying critical theory and psychological theory to real world political struggles and liberation struggles, towards the transformative, so education as a transformative practice, and also thinking about spaces. So for me, as part of the kind of decolonial impulse, it's about how we create spaces together within the university. I'd like to bring spirituality into the classroom, and thinking of different ways of challenging the hierarchies of the classroom. I visited the University of Southern Maine at the beginning of May, and I visited the Women and Gender Studies department, and they're saying that the boundaries they have with their students are not very good. They're quite like friendly in a good way, but the actual department is in a little house on campus, and it's like an actual converted house. And they're saying how students often come in and they come hang out in the offices, and they'll often find students in their offices doing like tarot and smudging when they're not around. And I just quite like the idea of challenging the hierarchy between lecturers and students, and that being ourselves together and having intersectional struggle. Of course there has to be some boundaries, but I think challenging that and thinking about power, getting students and staff to think about power in spaces, and also vulnerability. So getting try and get our students to be a lot more reflective of themselves and of ourselves. So we ask our students, a lot of them, to think about engaging with power and with questions of power and liberation struggles. So also modelling that ourselves, I think, is important. So there's some strategies.
In terms of, I was thinking, of course, you have questions are said by you and Tom, is how queer, so in essence, we're using it in terms of the verb, right? I was thinking that we have been talking of queer as adjective, as noun, as verb, and everything. That's what, in a way, the beauty of this term is. In terms of queer, and I mean, a lot of times, if you're interested in decolonizing issues, we're interested in race issues, we're interested in intersectional issues, including queer issues. The important thing is to bear in mind, and I've noticed this when I read a lot of, let's say, critique of homo-nationalism, critique of that, in a way, avoid similar critiques of, for instance, Black liberation or post-colonial liberation that may have misogynist or queerphobic elements. So for instance, Frantz Fanon, who's otherwise great, if you look at his work and you find queerphobia here, there's almost a silence around that. Mm-hmm. As if decolonizing, anti-colonial, post-colonial thought cannot bear the burden of critique in terms of misogyny or queerphobia. I thought that we have to bear that in mind. Now, in terms of practical strategies, I would see it in the partnership. Partnership, of course, remember, partnership always has hierarchy. It's not that they're always equal. But the idea is partnership with each other, but partnership with students. So that's something very clear, that we have to involve students all the time. second, and remember, in neoliberal university, students are consumers and customers or whatever, right? So in a way, if you have them as partners, university cannot say anything against you if you get them on board. Second is curriculum. Curriculum is very important to challenge it, change it. So the way we have worked within our department, for instance, is, I mean, we still don't have as much, let's say I'm using the word identity, right? Identity as I would have wanted it to be. And yet we deal with issues of race, issues of sexualities, of gender from year one, in addition to specialist modules on those, right? Otherwise we've not left it for level six specialist module. We start from year one, we try a level best. But the idea is we should have more of it rather than less of it. Curriculum is important. We need to engage different branches of university. We need to, as earlier speakers pointed out, public, be public about it. So what we are doing, for us to be radical educationists within the university and keep quiet about changing the world, does it make sense? Or be radical, for instance, and you know, we have academics like that, very radical in theory, radical democracy, radical everything in public, but within the university, anti-union, very complicit with the management, okay, I'm part of management, complicit with management, and we know that. So in a sense, we need to challenge that boundary and keep that there. Intersectionality works. So for instance, there would be a lot of students who would be interested in our case, for instance, in Islamophobia. But they may think that this queer sexuality issue is not their issue. But if you sort of converse with them, have conversation where they realize or acknowledge that what you are experiencing as a Muslim or as a black person or as a woman is something similar to what, let's say, in general, all queer people, including Muslims and black and everyone, experience. Often I've noticed students respond much better. So in a way, appeal to them, acknowledge them. As I have strategic allies, straight allies in this case. We need allies all the time. I understand the issue of radical politics, but I do believe that we need allies wherever possible. Sometimes we may get allies simply because they want to tick boxes, which is fine, let them do it. Sometimes we would get because they genuinely are transformed through the interaction with us, but we need that, and I think we are doing that quite good, and we should continue to do with that. And that's it, and be open to it all the time, but never go quiet. All I know, and I remember someone saying it, that you know, when people say, especially cis males saying, oh, straight acting, right? The point is, what's the point of long decades of queer struggle if we still end up saying straight acting? So in this context, what we know, people have fought for it, people have struggled for it, we are still fighting for it. So whatever we do, we should not silence ourselves for anything.
Thank you. I'm going to be brief as well. So I was trying to be practical, and thank you very much for what everybody said. So so for me, one of the first things, I'll pick up on some of the other things, one of the things that I think is really important in terms of methods for queering learning and teaching is with students to outline exactly what sort of institution that they're in. So what's expected of them? What's expected of us? How we're each judged, you know, because we're judged as well, and then you know, and what all that means in terms of university rankings and all of that, and the judgments that happen, and what happens with evaluation. How we're expected to teach in the first place, that you know, some methods are recognised and have value and are privileged over others, the kind of literature that we're expected to, that they're expected to know and that we're expected to use to a certain extent. All the various quality processes that we have to go through, and so yeah, so that's the first thing I do in an introductory session, so I do know teaching per se. In a first session, we spend lots of time sort of talking about those things, talking about the assignment, but linking it always back to this kind of thing. And all those processes and what that means for them, but also in, what it means for us as teachers. So that's one of the first things. So it's like paying attention to where does the power lie and how does it manifest itself in the university experience. And I also had something around political action, so it was nice that lots of people have talked about that, and I think you talked about, you know, being, you know, the importance of being participatory, and Rachel, yesterday you talked, you know, your fantastic talk about the strike and, you know, the anger and what it's meant in terms of the institution and what we're being asked to do all the time and how that makes us feel. I found that very powerful. And so then what do we do about that? So for me, you know, just a sort of few things other than that. And so challenging, I suppose for me, challenging absolutism, always challenging absolutism, and trying to explain that everything is about power. Everything is about power. Every dynamic is about power. Every interaction we have will involve power in some way. Everybody has an agenda. It's just understanding what that agenda is, and you know, and where you can fit yourself within that. As I said already, questioning data, questioning theory, questioning identity, questioning learning itself, being creative in our methods. And I suppose I wanted to finish with something that I sort of talk about with students, this idea that you should really be leaving every session with more questions than answers, something to then go away and think about, let alone leaving the sort of the course, the module, the program. And the commissioner said learning is about disruption and opening up to further learning, not closure and satisfaction. And I really love that. I love that idea of this concept of leaving with some satisfaction. So we're being asked, you know, students are asked to sort of judge how satisfied they are with what they've done what we've done with them in the classroom, what they've done in the classroom. And you know, to me, that is very much sort of challenging. That is, you know, challenging the no closure, and meeting with no closure, and maybe some satisfaction. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe now you can see why I enjoy the conversations that I get to have with the four of these people and how privileged I feel to get to have them.